Hi, everybody. This is Kate Manchester, and you are listening to Edible Communities. I'm the publisher of Edible Santa Fe, and every week we're going to be bringing you a different show from a different member of Edible Communities. Today on the show, we are going to be talking with Tracy Ryder and Carol Topalian, so we can really give you a great intro to Edible Communities and who we are. I know I came on board as number 16, and that was in 2006, and I believe we're about 54 communities at this point in 3 short years. So later in the show, we'll be talking with Elliot Coleman, and our sponsor today is the Hearst Ranch, and we want to send a big shout-out to Hearst Ranch and thank them for sponsoring our show. So we're going to get started with Tracy and Carol. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Kate.
Hi, ladies. Welcome to Edible Communities. This is a show about all of your communities that you've created.
Yay. Edible Communities has really turned into quite a big family, and it's a very varied and interesting group of people turning out an incredible product.
So tell me how many, tell me, or tell our listeners, I know how this started, but you need to tell our listeners how all of this started.
Well, Kate, Edible Communities started in the spring of 2001 when we launched our very first magazine, which was called Edible Ojai, and that was located, obviously, in Ojai, California. And Edible Ojai was around for about 2 years, and then it got some very nice national press attention. And from that press attention, we decided, wouldn't that be great to be able to deliver these magazines to communities all over the U.S. and Canada, which is what people were requesting from us. And so we decided to start expanding. And in the spring of 2004, we launched Edible Cape Cod. And from there, from 2004 to the spring this year of 2009, we've added 10 magazines a year every year since then. So we are a network of 55 regional food magazines as of right now.
And it's also interesting to note that these are all independently owned publications. So if somebody is publishing one in Santa Fe, they own it. If somebody's publishing one in Cape Cod, they own it. And they employ local people to write and photograph the stories of these quarterly magazines.
So from what I understand, that Edible Communities is now the biggest publisher of local food magazines in the country. And right now, we have a collective readership of about 15 million. Is that correct?
That's correct. We're printing actually 5 million printed magazines a year, and we conservatively estimate our pass-along rate for each magazine at 3.5 people. It's probably actually higher than that, but that would make it around 15 million readers a year. And if you combine that with over 1 million website visitors every month to our combined websites, which, you know, each of the magazines has a supporting website and Edible Communities has its own website, they're all combined, and that aggregate traffic is something like, you know, well over 1 million people a month looking at our website. That's a lot of readers every year.
You know, and these magazines are different but similar because they all feature farmers, retailers, in some cases, fishermen, ranchers. So that's the focus of these magazines, to talk about what's being done locally, who's doing it, and how to access it. And so readers have been not only reading these magazines, but that there's recipes in them, so they save them and collect them, and we have a very loyal readership.
Who is the first on board?
After Edible Ojai was Edible Cape Cod. And then during that first year, as we made a lot of decisions for how the company would grow, we had the Chesapeake Bay and Twin Cities and Phoenix and Sacramento came on. It really did start dotting the country. And then 2 years ago, we were really happy to start adding magazines in Canada as well.
So you're an international company now.
We're an international company. And I actually think we're the largest publisher of local food information in the world now, not just in North America.
That's extraordinary. So, Carol, tell us one of the things that I find remarkable. First of all, we've got two very talented ladies here, Tracy Ryder and Carol Topalian. You both had a very successful media company before you started the magazine.
Yes.
Did you intend, Carol, you're a photographer who's shown work. You've had more than 70 shows in the U.S. and Europe. A lot of your photos are showing up in the Edible publications all across the country. In fact, Carol travels to pretty much every community out there and takes photographs for the launch of each magazine. What were you guys doing, and how did you, I mean, did you ever imagine birthing this movement?
Not to the extent that it's grown. We knew, you know, in Ojai, the magazine, well, before the first one came out, you know, we did it for the love of it. We were interested in the growers. We were interested in food. So after the first one came out, people said, well, what else are you going to write about? And that was 7 years ago, and it's, you know, it's been out quarterly since then. But we, you know, we didn't expect the fast rate of growth that's happened and the interest in, you know, the communities all over the country and Canada. And it's just been the perfect informational source for what's going on in the country right now, in the world right now. So, yeah, one of the surprising things was being able to go on these, we call them launch trips, and help people get started. So it's amazing to go on the back roads and meet, you know, somebody who's raising goats and making goat cheese in places you'd never know about, ever. Even people who live in the communities didn't know about these people. And there's been a couple of instances where companies, small companies, have almost gone under and an Edible wrote about them, and they're thriving now.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
And I think that that's the unique quality of Edibles. I mean, you really do get to the real heart of the local food scene wherever you go if there's an Edible. And putting a face with the producer of your food, that's pretty special.
I think one of the most unique and special aspects of this company, too, is that because all the magazines are locally owned and operated by people who are leaders in their food communities, I think we have a real special thing happening all the time in that you get instantly, you know, it's not one of those publications where you go, oh, well, here is where the tourists would eat, or here's, you know, what you read about on the internet, or here's what's been reviewed in certain restaurant reviews or whatever. These are the real stories about real people who live and work in that community. And having our publishers be such incredible people who really care about the communities they live in and really know the food movement there brings a layer of quality and information to each of the magazines that, frankly, we just don't really see in a lot of other magazines, even ones that are doing great content. I mean, these are the heart and soul of many of the communities we publish in, and I think that's an incredible aspect.
You know, and another thing is that many of these people have no background in publishing, that they come to us because they're interested and passionate about the subject, and Edible Communities provides the kind of support they need to create their magazines, and they learn as they go. So we have everybody from, you know, people who've been bankers to people who've been farmers.
Private chefs.
And
for example.
Private chefs.
And do you think that that's part of, because I think that is remarkable also, the fact that most of these people, I certainly didn't have any publishing experience when I came to the magazine. I had a lot of passion and excitement, but I do know many members of this community, and I know that many of these people didn't have publishing experience, yet the magazines are gorgeous, I mean consistently gorgeous. Do you think that that's part of the formula for success?
Yes, and I think that one of the things that being part of this community does is each publisher shares their experiences, their knowledge, and so we get to take advantage of all of these skills that everybody brings, and it makes us all better. So this is a very positive, giving group of people who are not in competition with each other because, you know, their own territory is discrete. And so we have a listserv where people help each other out on a daily basis with information.
Yeah, I think that I definitely agree that that is one of the defining factors to our 100% success rate. I think the Edible Communities business model is quite different from most other publishing models. So the fact that our publishers haven't had to unlearn one way of publishing to relearn a new way, it certainly is an advantage. I mean, they get to come in fresh with all the passion that you talked about, Kate, and then, you know, just really learn a system that, you know, has proven itself over and over again and that works well. It's a manageable business to run, and after that first year of getting your feet on the ground and learning how to put out that magazine, it really, you know, we've been told over and over again how rewarding the work is and, you know, how well the model actually works.
We are also able to get together once a year. We have an annual meeting, and people who have been in communication all year with each other just by email or telephone get to meet in person. And the event, we have awards that are given for that not only the articles in the magazines, but for the local people in each community.
And that's actually a really terrific thing. It's one of the things as a publisher that I really enjoy is meeting all these faces, you know, all these people that you're talking to on the listserv every day and exchanging emails and exchanging information. There's an incredible amount of support that I don't think exists. I know it doesn't exist in other, it may exist in other communities, but I don't think there's any other publication that's set up as a community in quite this way.
Well, even with Kate, you mentioned about the photography. There, we are close to 50,000 images in our stock image pool that our members have access to all the time and get to use at no fee for as much as they need. So, and we have production people that are experts at what they do that support the publishers. So there's a huge amount of backup, mm-hmm. and it allows the publishers to really turn out, you know, a quality product.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, too, because I've talked to a lot of publishers in my own community that, you know, are using a traditional publishing model, and they're all looking at really giving Edible Communities a serious look because everybody knows that publishing is in big trouble right now.
Yeah.
Because these old models where you've got, you know, you're paying three staff people $60,000 a year, and you're paying a graphics department, and, you know, we kind of all work as a community. Mm-hmm. So I think that's also part of our success, too. Mm-hmm. And the truth is, since none of us have any experience, many of us don't have any preconceived notions about whether or not this is going to work or not work. Is this good? Are we doing this right? So that's pretty great. This is Edible Communities on Heritage Radio Network. This is Kate Manchester from Edible Santa Fe. And today we're talking with Tracy and Carol Topalian, introducing you to Edible Communities. And later in the show, we'll be talking with Elliot Coleman. So I know that you guys, you've got a new book coming out.
Right.
So when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about that. We're going to take a short break, and we'd like to thank our sponsor today, the Hearst Ranch. We'll be right back.
I got a rose between my toes from walking barefoot through the hothouse to you, pretty baby. I got a torn right near my corn from walking barefoot through the hothouse to you. And when I fell into the tomatoes,
so we're back with Tracy Ryder and Carol Topalian of Edible Communities, the founder of Edible Communities. They started with Edible Ojai and were quickly spotted by Savoir Magazine, who put them on the cover of their 100 favorite things and said, wouldn't it be great if these could crop up all over the country? So now with 55 publications?
55. Yes.
Largest publisher of local food publications in the world, with a readership of 15 million people, web presence. You're on to other kinds of media. So tell us a little bit about the website and about Edible Nation.
Right. Well, the website is ediblecommunities.com, and through that portal you can reach all of the individual edible magazines at their own sites. They're all linked together right now. We have over 1 million unique visitors every month coming through to our sites. We hear from people all the time that they plan vacations and trips to communities all over North America using our magazines and their websites. So they're a very good resource for local food information in communities all over the place. Each one represents a distinct culinary region from North America, so they're really good resources for when you're traveling. They're also equally good. We hear from the people who live in communities all the time that say things like, you know, we've lived here our entire lives and we had no idea there was a cheesemaker down the street or an oysterman or a rancher. So they seem to be resources that work well for local residents of the communities as well as visitors. So we're very proud of that.
Also, you know, people who have moved away from their community are able to subscribe to these. I mean, local people can subscribe too, but it's nice to be able to stay in touch with what's going on in your old hometown, and this is a really wonderful way to do that. So all of them are available through subscription.
A lot of them are on the website too, so if you're not really sure, visit www.ediblecommunities.com and start scrolling through some of these communities and look at the quality of some of these publications and the quality of the writing. A lot of the writers that we're getting, too, we're getting a lot of really terrific writers. I know in my own community we have Deborah Madison has written for us, Mark Winnie. You have an Edible Nation column. And this, people often ask me, do you guys share content? And most of the time we don't, because most of the content we're gathering from our own communities. But we do have something that's called an Edible Nation column that may or may not be written. Tracy, why don't you talk a little
bit
about
it? Right. We do have one column, Edible Nation, every quarter, where we have been actually contacted by many, many renowned writers from all over North America who have offered to contribute to that piece. We've had everyone from Barbara Kingsolver, Sam Fromarts, Anna LaPay, some really high-profile writers who are very active in the local food movement. So each of our magazines then has the option of running that content. This spring and last fall we had Wendell Berry, and just we're going to have Michael Pollan. I mean, there's a great lineup of really renowned national writers who are very happy to contribute to our magazines, and we're really proud of that.
And you also have Edible Nation blog.
We do have an Edible Nation blog, and we also have another blog at ediblestories.com.
And who's writing that, pray tell?
That is Carol and I, and it is our adventures as we travel. And right now we're starting to cook recipes from the pages of various edible magazines and take pictures of them, so we're posting regional recipes from all around the edible community at large.
And many of these recipes are going to appear in the upcoming book.
Excellent. Right. That's great. We're going to talk a little bit about the book a little bit later. So Bruce Cole, who's the publisher of Edible San Francisco, writes the Edible Nation blog.
Right.
And how did that come about? That's actually been around,
I think it's been around close to 3 years now, actually. Definitely for a little over two. Bruce Cole, for those of you who have read his writing, used to be the publisher of a blog called Sauté Wednesday, which was very popular and had a lot of press attention that was always mentioned in the New York Times and different publications. Bruce is a brilliant and quirky and outspoken, fabulous writer who is a great advocate for the local foods movement. And so we put him in charge of Edible Nation.
And he's the publisher of Edible San Francisco.
Because we just knew that politically, with all the issues going on, you know, Bruce is like our in-house investigative journalist. So he you know, keeps his finger on the pulse of everything going on, and those kinds of leads are what he posts at Edible Nation.
That's great. So we've got book talk coming up after this. I want to talk a little bit about new media. I know a lot of the edibles are Twittering, they're Facebooking. Any thoughts on any of that?
You know, social networking is really an amazing phenomenon in our world right now, as you well know. And since we are a community within a community, there's a lot of edibles at Twitter. If you just type the word edible into Twitter, you know, you'll get, you know, 20 or 25 of our magazines there, as well as Edible Stories, which is our tweets that we do as often as possible. We try to do it at least once a day. And Facebook as well. I mean, there are fan pages to many of the Edible magazines. There's an Edible Communities page there. There's Edible Communities fan page there. You know, we're all, the web year, they say, is 3 months long instead of 12 months long. So every quarter it seems like we are learning about something new. But the social networking I find to be very interesting and kind of compelling in a way, because, you know, we have 600 or 700 people following us at Twitter and at Facebook, and, you know, they're readers who generally have seen us in one community or another because of the printed magazine, and then they've gone to the website, and then they start to follow. I think it's a nice way to layer and get sort of multiple, you know, contact with our readers. Our magazines, for the most part, are all quarterly, so many of them have e-newsletters, and with Facebook and with Twitter and even Flickr now, I've started uploading to Flickr, they get a lot more contact.
One of the most popular things on that is recipes.
You know what? We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. This is Kate Manchester with Edible Communities here on Heritage Radio Network. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Hearst Ranch, today. And we are back with Tracy Ryder and Carol Topalian. They are the founders of Edible Communities, a community of 55 local food publications all across the country and Canada. We were just talking about social networking. And Carol?
Well, I was just saying that a lot of the information passed back and forth is about sort of recipes, what to do. You know, rhubarb is out in Santa Fe Farmers Market as we speak. And so we just used a recipe from, I think, Martha's Vineyard. And, of course, people saw that and had other ideas for other ways, you know, to use a rhubarb. So it's a great way to share that kind of information.
Let's talk a little bit about your new book, because this is really exciting.
The book is being put together and published by John Wiley & Sons out of New York. It's going to have lots of stories and lots of photographs and some really yummy recipes. We've divided the book up into regions. And so we concentrate on the regions and the seasons.
It's the working title right now is called Edible, the Story on Local Food, which we hope will stick.
Love it.
And so we have North America is divided into 6 regions. Within each region, we have profiles of the people who, at our annual meeting every year, each community nominates the local food heroes from each of their individual communities. And many of those stories have made it onto the pages of this book, which we're very proud of, and we can't wait to see all bound and in print and ready to go.
Which
and
probably isn't coming out until...
It's March of 2010. It'll be out. And along with that are 75 recipes that have been submitted from regions all over the country, many of which... You know, came to us from our own publishers. and they're really delicious. We just recently, Carol just photographed. We had a stylist and a chef and some home cooks, and everyone cooked and styled, and she photographed recipes, and the photos are just gorgeous.
And then everybody got to eat them afterwards, and everybody was going, wow, this is really good.
So, and our publisher in Toronto, Gail Gordon Oliver, is a professional recipe developer and writer, and Gail came on board with this project to really help us with that section of the book, and we're very grateful that she did because it was a lot of work. And so we're really happy that the recipes are in such great shape and that are really, really delicious and go according to region and season.
So you said the book will be out?
March of 2010.
March of 2010. Fantastic. So will it be, it'll be for sale, I'm sure, on the Edible Communities website.
Correct, and within each of our communities. And Carol and I will actually be traveling to many of those communities for book events during next year. And I'm sure it'll be everywhere. We'll make it available everywhere.
So we're talking about Edible, the word on local food, is that right?
Yes.
The word on local food.
The word on local food.
I love it.
Yeah.
And these are all Carol's photographs?
They are, with a few exceptions. There's a couple of profiles of people that she wasn't able to get to in time for the book, but for the most part, it's 288 pages of hardbound, full-color, fabulous edible images. And
I want to know how many photographers in the world have this kind of gig. I think Carol is the only photographer in the world that's created this kind of...
I lucked out, didn't I?
You did, but I remember early on when I first met both of you, and Carol said something about her dream was to visit or to travel all over the country taking photographs. What did you say? You said...
Yeah, taking photographs and... You know, I love sort of the back roads and the back doors of places. And, you know, usually when you travel, I mean, you try to, you know, ferret out wonderful places. But as I go to these, as we go to these places, it's our publishers in the local areas have already planned out who we're going to see and go visit. And we were just on Martha's Vineyard last week, and we were taking dirt roads that I would have never knew existed, and ended up, you know, seeing oxen, you know, and just we did go see oysters, but one of the most exciting things for me was these scallops. Scallops have eyes.
Yes, they do.
Blue eyes. That's
blue
right.
Eyes.
I would have never, you know, it was wonderful.
So apparently you've never been skin diving for scallops. That was one of my pastimes when I was a kid.
No, I didn't. And, you know, where we went, I used my close-up lens, and, oh, my golly, they're like little jewels.
They are.
Beautiful.
They're absolutely gorgeous.
Like,
yeah. So those kinds of things, you know, would be really difficult to find on your own, and just it's been amazing.
So collectively, I just wanted to mention again that Edible Communities, we are 55 publications and growing across the country in Canada, and we share a very loose mission statement, and that is to reconnect people to their local food shed. And I think that so far so good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just, I mean, the first one outside of Ojai, Cape Cod, I think they've doubled the size of their farmers markets. You know, those kinds of things have been happening again and again and again.
They've been able to bring back an event, you know, in the fall for, it's called the Cape Land and Sea Harvest, which was an old oyster event that had kind of gone away, and now it's not only a new oyster event, but it includes special menus on all the restaurants during the shoulder seasons on the Cape where they need more visitors. Edible Austin has created the Eat Local Week in December in Austin every year. You and Santa Fe Kate are a phenomenon. I mean, you have so many things happening here and so many fabulous things you've done for this community, including, you know, the, is it Field to Plate?
Farm to Restaurant.
Farm to Restaurant. I always get those Field to Whatever's mixed up a little bit. And with the expansion of our farmers market here, and you know, it's just, it's absolutely phenomenal, the work. You know, our publishers work to produce award-winning, high-quality, beautiful magazines, and yet the amount of community service work that goes on
behind the scenes
is really a phenomenon. I mean, it's remarkable.
I'd like to thank you both for being here today. And again, you're listening to Heritage Radio Network. This is Kate Manchester of Edible Communities, and we were talking with Tracy Ryder and Carol Topelian, the founders of Edible Communities. And you can find out more about Edible Communities and the work that we do on www.ediblecommunities.com. We'll be right back with Elliot Coleman, and thanks to Hearst Ranch for sponsoring our show today. So if you're just tuning in, I am Kate Manchester of Edible Santa Fe, a member of Edible Communities, and we'd like to thank our sponsor today, Hearst Ranch, for making this show possible. So up next, we're going to be talking with Elliot Coleman. A report by the National Gardening Association is really encouraging. It predicts a 19% increase in home food gardening, with 43 million U.S. households saying they plan to grow their own fruit and vegetables this year. And the traditional American garden begins in May and ends in October, unless you're Elliot Coleman. Elliot's had more than 30 years of experience in all aspects of organic farming, including field vegetables, greenhouse vegetables, rotational grazing of cattle and sheep, and range poultry. He's the author of The New Organic Grower, Four Season Harvest, and his brand new book is called The Winter Harvest Handbook. And he and his wife, Barbara Damrosch, grow produce year-round at Four Season Farm in, of all places, Harborside, Maine. Welcome, Elliot.
Thank you very much, Kate.
So I've been looking at, I've actually been a long-time fan of yours. And I read Four Season Harvest, I guess, when it first came out back in 1992, I guess it was. And I have a coveted dog-eared copy that's, you know, spent lots of hours with me in the garden. And I was thrilled to hear that you came out with the Winter Harvest Handbook. I happen to live in New Mexico, and I'm really curious about, even living here in New Mexico, how people can get more involved with year-round growing. And I've always was struck by the fact that you did this in Maine. So how did this whole journey start with you?
Oh, I think it's mostly stubbornness, Kate. As a grower and someone who loves to eat fresh food as much of the year as possible, I just wasn't ready to pack it in once October turned into November and then into December. And so year by year, we just kept playing around with simple measures of protection that weren't going to use any energy. We started out with the old-time cold frame, and then we got height tunnels. And then one year, we put a cold frame inside a height tunnel. And bingo, that was the great leap forward.
And when you say a height tunnel, is that what you said?
Yeah, a height tunnel is just a hoop greenhouse. That's the grower's name for them. Something you can walk into that has usually a sheet of plastic over it, and here on the East Coast makes the difference of moving the interior protected climate about 500 miles to the south.
I thought that was fascinating, Elliot, when I read that. So just by putting it in the cold frame, it moves you to a different, what do you call that, temperate zone, I guess?
Or a different latitude or a different part of the country.
Right.
So for us here on the East Coast, whereas I'm in Maine, a single layer of protection will move the protected area to a climate that's something like the winter climate in New Jersey. And then if I put a second layer inside my little greenhouse, about a foot above the ground, that's what we learned when we put the cold frame inside, all of a sudden the climate in there is all the way down in Georgia.
That's amazing.
And that isn't to say that it doesn't freeze in there, because it does freeze in Georgia in the winter. But we don't have any tomatoes or peppers or eggplants in there. We have spinach and Swiss chard and scallions and carrots and hardy lettuces and plants that don't mind a little freezing and thawing in the winter.
So, and I had read, too, that you started this whole journey. You spent a lot of time in Europe talking to market farmers. And that you were inspired by seeing Scott and Helen Nearing's garden. I'm curious about your travels in Europe and what you saw there, and why is Europe so different than America? I mean, most of us came from Europe at one point. So why did we stop gardening in the winter?
Yeah, that's a great question. I first got a chance to go visit other growers and gardeners in Europe in 1974. And I was very, very impressed. The level of organic agriculture at that point over there was way ahead of what we were doing here. And part of it was the fact that Europe had never lost its small farms. Europe didn't have a California. And so if they wanted to eat all winter, they had to figure out how to grow it right where they were. And therefore, there were lots of cold frames and greenhouses and commercial-style cold frames, actually, way back then, that have since all now turned into plastic hoop houses or even large heated greenhouses in many countries. And so the small farm was alive and well, and production there was just thriving in the winter. But we used to have very amusing conversations with some of the growers over there, because the thing everybody told us when we got started here was we'd never be able to do it because there wasn't enough day length, wasn't enough sunlight in winter. Well, it turns out that Europe is so much further north on the globe than the U.S. that the same parallel of latitude that we're on here in the middle of Maine runs across southern France. And so we'd be driving across southern France, visiting gardeners and growers, and we'd always ask them, gee, is there enough sunlight here to do this? And they'd say, oh, gosh, there's plenty of sunlight. The problem is the cold. Huh. Well, at that point, we would break into peals of raucous laughter because of what they called cold, we called June up here in Maine. and so the day length thing turned out to not to be a problem at all, and even less so for you down in Santa Fe. I mean, Santa Fe is on the 36th parallel, I think?
I believe so.
That's down in the Carolinas here on the East Coast.
Or Africa. Aren't we in the same parallels as Africa or some parts of Africa?
Northern Africa, yeah.
Right.
So you're getting plenty of sun. All you need is a little protection for the hardy greens to keep the wind from drying them out on your cold nights.
And maybe some water would help us, too.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing is here in the winter, we don't water at all in our greenhouses from November to February, because the sun is low enough in the sky that there's very little evaporation. And the water table is higher in the earth in the winter because there isn't so much heat and sun.
That's really interesting. I was going to ask you about that, because even here in New Mexico, they tell us to water at least once a week in the winter if we've got, you know, trees or you know, fruit trees, that kind of thing. So you don't do any watering from November.
Right, and once you get into a greenhouse, the moisture in there is actually recycling. It isn't blowing away into the dry desert air. And so, again, it's a wonderful way to conserve water.
Hmm. Very interesting. Elliot, we're going to have to take a break here for just a minute. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Hearst Ranch, today. And we'll be back in just a minute. Back with Elliot Coleman, and we're talking about his new book, The Winter Harvest Handbook. So, Elliot, we were talking a little bit about water and growing times and sunlight. Are there certain greens or vegetables that lend themselves better to winter planting and eating? Because I know a lot of times when you're planting things in the wintertime, there's certain things that kind of get bitter or that maybe aren't so great to plant and eat in the wintertime.
Well, the best ones are the leafy green vegetables that actually much prefer a cool, moist climate to a hot and dry one, and so you have the perfect cool, moist climate in a winter cold frame or a winter greenhouse. And those are things like arugula. All of the Asian greens are just excellent, like bok choy, things like mizuna, another wonderful one called tatsoi, which has a dark green leaf like spinach and is a wonderful winter food. And then there are certain types of beet greens that thrive. There's types of Swiss chard, Claytonia, a California weed, also known as miner's lettuce, is a delicious winter salad. And then you have your endives and a number of hardy lettuces. There's the European classic mâche or corn salad that you always see in French salads in the middle of the winter. There's an Italian weed called minutina that has a wonderful crunch in a winter salad. You can keep parsley and herbs like that going all winter long. You can have scallions. And then probably the star of all is spinach. If people were only to do one winter green, I would suggest spinach. Plant it sometime around the middle of September and protect it. And what goes on with spinach is sort of a winter annual plant. It likes the short days. It likes the cool weather. And it doesn't even think about going to seed until it gets longer days. So spinach that you plant in the middle of September, you can start eating on into November some point. And every time you pick a leaf, it'll grow a new leaf, and you'll be eating that bed of spinach right on through to April.
And one of the things that's really surprising that I learned this winter is that spinach gets very, very sweet in the wintertime. It has almost a different flavor than spinach that's grown in the summer.
Yes, yes. That happens to a lot of vegetables. Whatever the technical scientific reason is, I just assume that in order to protect themselves against cold, these plants are changing some of their starch to sugar, and that's why they're so much sweeter and more delicious in the winter.
It's really interesting. So what can people do in their own backyards, and how low-tech is this? Because I've read all of your books, and it doesn't look like you need, you know, a lot of expensive equipment or a greenhouse. I mean, the hoop house, we call it a hoop house. You call it a high tunnel or?
Yeah, no, you don't need anything like that. My daughter, who lives out in Colorado, had a wonderful little operation one winter where they had a number of hay bales left around, and they stacked them too high as the back wall of a very large cold frame and one lying on its side for the front wall, laid some 2x4s across there, and stretched a sheet of plastic over it. And
that
simple little structure fed them salads all winter long.
That's pretty easy. Now, I know we're talking to you today, but I also wanted to mention that your wife, Barbara, she has a weekly column in the Washington Post called A Cook's Garden, and she's actually written several books. She's quite the gardener, too, I understand.
Yes, she tolerates me around here. her books actually, Kate, outsell mine about 5-1, so she's definitely the star of the family.
That's amazing. Well, in case people are just tuning in, we are talking with Elliot Coleman of Four Season Farm, and we're talking about Elliot's new book, The Winter Harvest Handbook, and you can visit Elliot and Barbara at fourseasonfarm.com. If you'd like more information. And Elliot, are you out there, are you speaking, are you teaching, what else are you doing besides growing, as if that isn't enough?
Well, yeah, I have done more speaking engagements in the past than I'm doing now. I feel I've sort of put in my time, and I'd much rather stay here because we always have so many interesting experiments going on the farm one way or the other. And then there's, of course, the fact that if we're growing all this beautiful produce, we got to get it harvested and get it to the stores. But you'll probably see me around at some point. We did come to New Mexico and speak a number of years ago and had a wonderful time. That's just such a beautiful part of the world.
It's gorgeous here. It's really beautiful. And I think the potential for year-round growing is really beginning to catch on here. And I know that a lot of our farmers, New Mexico is still very much an agricultural state and rural, very rural in many, many places. And it hasn't really lost that rural beauty that's kind of disappearing across America. And we've got a thriving farmers market here. Actually, we've got 58 farmers markets in New Mexico right now, but I know the one in Santa Fe is, I think, in the top 10 in the country. And I talked to a lot of farmers about...
I think that's very impressive. Wow.
It's pretty good. I mean,
yeah.
We've got, during high season, we've got about 160 farmers selling, you know, two or three times a week at the market. We'd have more. And I think we're going to expand that market. We've just got a brand new farmers market building, so a permanent home for the farmers. So hopefully we're going to expand our farmers market days, which will expand our farmers.
It's so great to see that movement growing the way it is here. If you drive through small European towns, they all have a building there for their weekly or biweekly farmers market because it's been such a tradition for so long. And it's wonderful to see what's happening here and that towns and villages are realizing that this is definitely something they should encourage.
Indeed. It's amazing that we ever lost it, but it's only been a short time. So I think, you know, I think that with what's happening all across America right now, I think this is, I love the resurgence of gardens, of victory gardens, of farms and farmers and farm stands and CSA. It's really encouraging.
If people want to eat well, they quickly realize that the best food is the food coming from somewhere nearby. And the old saying has always been that the best way to eat well is to know the first name of your farmer.
I believe that wholeheartedly. Elliot, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
I got a rose between my toes from walking barefoot through the hot house to you.
So we're finishing our time with Elliot Coleman. We're talking about his new book, The Winter Harvest Handbook. Elliot, I wanted to ask you, what do you think, I mean, I sort of covet all of these books. What do you think the biggest difference in, or the differences in Four Season Harvest and the Winter Harvest Handbook are?
Well, the wonderful thing about the... getting older and getting more years of experience is that you learn things that you didn't know a few years ago. And so another 10 years or so of background on this and the trials that we've run just fleshed out a whole lot of the ideas that we knew had legs to them, but we didn't know which direction they were running in. And so the Winter Harvest Handbook just sort of completes the cycle. And also... ups the cycle to a larger scale operation. I wrote the Four Season Harvest for home gardeners because that was where these ideas began. Barbara and I were playing around with all these things in our backyard with just cold frames and then our own little small plastic greenhouse. And then once we started doing it commercially, wow, then there was a chance to learn twice as much and try all sorts of other exciting crops. So the Winter Harvest Handbook is just takes the ideas and deepens the quality and quantity of knowledge that is available.
How big is your farm, Elliot?
Put it in New England terms, we own 40 acres more or less, as the deed says. And of that 40 acres, there's only about 12 acres that are either flat enough or dry enough or unrocky enough to clear, and so we have we've cleared the 12 acres, and of that there's about 6 acres in pastures for livestock, and then there's the vegetables, fruit trees, houses, sheds, and roads, et cetera, on the other 6 acres.
So, and your farm stand is open, is it, will you tell me, when is it open?
Yeah, our farm stand is open about 4 months of the year, from the 1st of June to the end of September. And then we also have a wonderful little mobile farm stand, the veggie wagon, as we call it, a trailer where the sides fold out and the back folds out, and we take that to different farmers markets around here. And we're also doing something which I suggest other growers might want to look into. If we think there's an area that is what you might call underserved by a farmer's market, we can take the veggie wagon down there on a certain day that we advertise and see if there's great potential there, too.
I think that's great. So I encourage everybody to get a copy of Elliot's books at your local neighborhood bookseller and to visit fourseasonfarm.com, or better yet, on your summer road trip this year, visit Maine and go visit Four Season Farm. You can find all the information and directions on fourseasonfarm.com, and you can also find out where Elliot or Barbara will be lecturing, signing books in your town. And Elliot, I'd love to thank you for being with us today, and I wish you the best of luck.
Oh, you're welcome, Kate, and it's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you so much. So we're back. This is Kate Manchester from Edible Communities. I'm the publisher of Edible Santa Fe and a member of Edible Communities. And we were just talking with Tracy Ryder and Carol Topalian, who are our fearless leaders and founders of Edible Communities today. And in case you're just tuning in, Edible Communities is a mission-driven community, a membership organization, I guess we call ourselves. And we are all about reconnecting people to their local food sheds. So in that vein, we write about farmers and cheesemakers and winemakers in your community. So if you don't have an edible in your community and you'd like to have an edible in your community, please log on to ediblecommunities.com to find out how you can make that happen. It's a fantastic community, and it's wonderful to be part of this mission-driven movement around local food. Thanks to Elliot Coleman and our sponsor, Hearst Ranch, today for making this show possible. These shows are going to be archived on the web at heritageradionetwork.com, so I encourage you to check back often for new content. We'll be live at 5 every Monday, 5 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. And next week on the show, we've got Heidi from Heidi's Raspberry Farm here in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Actually, they're not in Santa Fe, but they're in New Mexico. And we'll be talking with Deborah Madison and Patrick McFarland. They've got a new book out called What We Eat When We Eat Alone, and we'll be talking to Deborah about some of the work that she does. So please check back anytime. Again, Heritage Radio Network, and I encourage you to email or call with any suggestions that you have. You can reach me personally, Kate, at ediblesantafe.com. If you've got questions, comments, suggestions for guests, anything at all, give us a holler and tune in every week at 5. Thanks, and we'll talk to you next week. Bye. Hi, everybody.